come on in and spend some time with the film hobbyist. My name is Lydia, and I love movies. We are here in my attic room. You're sitting on a forest green Walmart futon. I'm in an old desk chair. Behind me is my desk. It's not a very impressive piece of furniture. Just a hand-me-down L-framed construction, simple metal frame with black vinyl boards on top. But it's fairly full. There are stacks of papers, notebooks, reference texts. There are also bits of yarn and thread, some stray needles, coils of wire, bags of beads. I love movies, but I think it's important to remind you that I'm a film hobbyist. As in, I have no professional history or training in film whatsoever. I didn't go to film school. I didn't study it in college. Watching movies, reading about them, talking about them, this is what I do for fun, for pure interest and enjoyment. I actually do have a career, something I've studied and practiced and invested years of my life in. I'm a novelist. I'm also very slow at revision, so I'm not actually published yet. But I'm waist deep in a final draft on one project, and I have multiple completed drafts of other projects, plus a smattering of things I can finish when I want to. I love writing. I love being with my characters and knowing them intimately. I love the thrill of imagining and of chiseling out a first draft, watching a story emerge from the white page as if it already existed fully formed in my subconscious. I'm also a craftsperson. I crochet dolls and plushies. It's so much fun. It's like three-dimensional illustrations. I try to capture faces and characters with just yarn and thread. It's a delight. If you look behind me, you can see the 2-foot-long dragon I've been working on, Haku from Spirited Away, crocheted in embroidery thread. He's almost done. That one's for my husband. But other works I've sold. I've done commissions and craft fairs. It's not much, but it's enough to feel satisfied in my work and its skill. I love stories. And I love making things. It's hard to articulate the joy these things bring me, the crafting of a book or a doll, the joy of creating and imagining and discovery, of work well done. But sometimes you find stories that articulate it for you. And that's how I feel about 1938's You Can't Take It With You, directed by Frank Capra. I first discovered Frank Capra the way most people do, through his masterpiece and notorious flop, It's a Wonderful Life. It bombed so hard at the box office that it bankrupted its independent studio, Liberty Films, and ended up in the public domain. So when TV channels were trying to fill Christmas programming slots, they didn't have to spend money to use it. The nostalgia of seeing it broadcasted year after year led audiences to reevaluate the film, which led to its place as a Christmas classic. Growing up, we owned it on VHS. And I watched it young enough that the character I identified most with was Zuzu, the protagonist's youngest daughter. In middle school, we watched Mr. Smith Goes to Washington as part of my social studies class. It's an idealistic civics lesson and a cynical political drama all in one. Not a bad way to show what we hope for America and what we painfully discover it truly is. And I recognized Capra's name. From the library, I watched Capra's other classics. Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, It Happened One Night, Arsenic and Old Lace, movies that are remembered and discussed and enjoyed. So I also grabbed You Can't Take It With You out of a sense of completionism. It's a Frank Capra film with Jimmy Stewart. Lionel Barrymore's in it too. And yes, it won Best Picture. Isn't that funny? One of those Best Picture winners that don't get talked about as much anymore. But what I found instead was a movie that spoke to my soul, that captured feelings I already had, hopes I had for my life. If you read a description of this film, it will inevitably be called a romantic comedy or a screwball comedy. I think the latter is more accurate, although it still fails to capture the real thrust of this story. Yes, it is a comedy, and yes, there is a romance, but I think it's more accurate to describe this as a philosophical debate between two patriarchs over their worldviews. On one side, we have Anthony P. Kirby, a Wall Street banker returning from a successful trip lobbying in D.C. for a contract that would allow him to force his competition into an aggressive merger. He is a man who cares about money and power and his financial empire. His life is his business. His legacy is his business. Which is why he's promoted his son to be vice president. After all, he's Anthony P. Kirby Jr. The work is his inheritance. On the other side, we have Grandpa Martin Vanderhoff. Years ago, he worked at a big, important job. But one day, on his way to work, he realized that he didn't enjoy it, and that he'd much rather spend his days doing what he enjoyed than grinding at a job that only gave him money in return. After all, when you die, you can't take it with you. So he went home and devoted his time to collecting stamps and instilling his family and community with his sense of value. He already owned his house. What more could he want? So in that house with him lives his sprawling family. His middle-aged daughter, a playwright of melodramas, her husband, who invents fireworks in the basement with their former Iceman, a full-grown granddaughter who makes candy and is an aspiring dancer, married to a printer and xylophonist, and another granddaughter, Alice, who, while having the perfectly ordinary aspiration of being a stenographer, enjoys sliding down the banisters and having the freedom of her own opinions. These two men, their families, and their worldviews are thrust into conflict in two ways. First, in order to complete his aggressive merger, Anthony P. Kirby, or AP as he's called, needs to buy up the 12 blocks that surround his competitors' factories. And he has, with the exception of a single house. Grandpa Vanderhoff's house. AP thinks he can offer Grandpa a pile of cash and the man'll move on. After all, money is the most important thing in the world, second only to business and power. Offer a man enough money and he'll do whatever you want. But of course, Grandpa doesn't care about money. The second source of their conflict is the real plot engine of the story. As I said, AP has a son, Tony. He's made Tony vice president of his whole operation. But this is a complete and utter nepo hire. Tony doesn't really want to have anything to do with the whole thing. He's bored out of his mind. In college, he did have ambitions. We find out later that he had big dreams of scientific breakthroughs and technological advances. He was kind of a proto-solar energy guy. He wanted to study chlorophyll to see if understanding how plants turn sunlight into food could be harnessed to address food insecurity, a definite alternate energy difficulty of his day. But then he realized the difficulty of funding and labs And there was all this pressure from his dad, so he gave it all up. Tony is played by Jimmy Stewart, and this is maybe the most unlikable role I've ever seen him in. He's bored, a little entitled, has a kind of shiftless energy, although you can see in moments a real, vibrant human being under all that nonsense. Anyway, here he is, bored, listless, in a job he doesn't want to do, stuck in his office all day, not doing much except hanging out with his stenographer, because of course, he has a stenographer. And who's his stenographer? Why, it's Alice, Grandpa Vanderhoff's granddaughter. Jean Arthur plays her as this spunky, lively kind of woman, utterly charming and endlessly fascinating. I've seen a lot of summaries and discussions of this film calling Alice the only ordinary one in the family, and I don't agree with that take at all. Her aspirations might be ordinary, but she isn't. Grandpa's philosophy isn't about making art. It's about doing what you enjoy and caring about people and community more than caring about money. Alice isn't a stenographer to make money. She's a stenographer for the fun of it. It's good work, and she enjoys doing it. Although, of course, she isn't doing much work at Tony's office. We meet the two of them pretty far into their romance. You get the sense that since she got the job, she mostly spends the day hanging out with him, like two high schoolers working at a job in a resort town in the off-season, where there isn't much to do but talk and goof off. You can see immediately why Tony would fall for Alice, and with her all spunky and wonderful, she brings out the life in him. He's playful and absolutely delighted with her. And when he proposes in their first scene together, she says yes. The next step is, of course, for their families to meet. It is this romance that brings these two philosophies crashing into each other, exacerbated by the screwball contrivance of AP's business deal and Grandpa's house. You know that there will be hijinks and laughs and some cringing, as well as a happy ending. It's a delightful ride to go on, one I highly recommend. Track it down through your local library, or look around online. Last I saw, it was on YouTube, free with ads. But the piece of this movie that really stuck with me, really washed over me, was the core of Grandpa's philosophy. He calls himself and his family lilies, referencing a passage from the Bible, part of what's called the Sermon on the Mount in the book of Matthew. Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even King Solomon in all his splendor was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, how much more will he clothe you? Grandpa says he and his family are lilies. They might toil and spin a little, but they don't need to worry about money or financial gain. What good would that be? They trust that all their needs will be provided for. And so they can be generous with their time and attention and their home. We see that Grandpa and his family are beloved in their community. Their table is open to guests. The music and the candy and the fireworks make enough money for them to get by and bring life to their neighborhood. Not all of this film holds up to modern values. Grandpa has strong opinions on not having to pay taxes, and the family employs a black cook whose depiction doesn't do much to challenge 1930s racial stereotypes. But I think their community investment and their trust that all their needs will be provided for as they work at what brings them joy, continues to challenge the status quo. And, as I said, it meant a lot to me personally. I decided I wanted to be a writer when I was 12. Settling on the answer to that ubiquitous, frankly terrible question we ask children, what do you want to be when you grow up? Had taken me a lot of time and energy and thought. I loved to sing and to act too, but writing struck me as the kind of work I could spend my whole life pursuing. It didn't come effortlessly, but the fact that I needed to focus my efforts more, that I would need to study and practice and grow, was delightful to me, a joyful challenge. So I finally started telling the adults in my life. I thought they would be thrilled. I had finally decided on an answer to the question I'd been asked as long as I could remember. But they merely countered with another question. How are you going to make money? I didn't have a good answer. I've always been a notoriously bad teacher. Storytelling and explaining aren't the same thing as practically passing down skills, especially to those who aren't interested. I knew even back then that I struggled with planning and administration. And I'm definitely stronger with intellectual and people skills than physical labor. During my years in middle school and high school, I took at least 5 separate career tests. I think that as a small school district in rural Appalachia, they were hoping to encourage their students to make plans, to know that they had options beyond what their parents did, or working at Walmart, options that might require leaving home permanently or just long enough to get a degree and come back. So I took 5 separate career tests. And frustratingly enough, every single one of them said the same thing. I should work in the arts. This didn't answer the burning question. It made it worse. I finally decided to start telling people that I was going to work whatever minimum wage job I could find and live in a garret. That's a 19th century attic room, the cheapest, worst kind of place to live, hot in the summer, cold in the winter. It was frequently associated with writers and artists because it was what they could afford. It's the capital R romantic signifier of being a starving artist. And it was a good answer, because it diffused the tension with a joke. I could toss off the phrase with an air that left room for something else. But there was nothing else. What on earth could I do? I couldn't imagine living my life, spending my time doing anything else but participating in the arts. The gift you can't take it with you gave to me was that of an alternate view. Grandpa's family isn't rolling in dough. They're put under financial pressure in the course of this story. But they know there has to be another way of living than what society expects. What good is spending an entire third of your life toiling at what feels like death and what encourages death for the accumulation of a legacy that ends with you? Over the course of this story, AP's assumptions are challenged, and he realizes how fragile it all is, this scrapping, bean-counting, anti-humanity accumulation of wealth. It isn't wrong to earn money. It is wrong to care about money more than people, the accumulation of money more than the act of creating or of participating in life. I know all this can easily be dismissed as idealism and sentimentality, That's the brush with which Frank Capra's films are usually painted, and it's why Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is shown to middle schoolers and not college students. Capra, the argument goes, is more fit for the young, the starry-eyed. It's films of later eras that got to the truth of real life, of the necessity of struggle and striving. I do have a different perspective on Capra's work, now that I'm a full-grown adult with years of pain and suffering and real life under my belt. These days, You Can't Take It With You doesn't hit me like it did in high school, as a sort of manifesto for how I hoped to live my life, making art in my garret. These days, You Can't Take It With You makes me cry. I'm not a published novelist. I'm waist-deep in a final draft of a novel, struggling through revision, trying to write actual good sentences. My crochet business is in flux these days, waiting to see if the next craft fair will be a better fit for my product than the last. I spend most of my days as a full-time parent, trying to find meals that everyone in my family will eat. You Can't Take It With You makes me cry because it tells me that I made the right choice. Maybe I could have buried my artistic ambitions underground and concentrated on making money, forcing myself into a corporate job that I hated and took up all of my time and energy. Maybe, if I had given up having a family or sleeping, I could have continued to make art, making that my monetized hobby. I could have striven. I could have slaved to make that happen. Or maybe I could have turned my writing into a machine, forgetting about good sentences and just pumping out books for the self-publishing market as quickly as I could. Again, there's nothing wrong with corporate jobs or monetized hobbies or professional writing. There's nothing wrong with being a stenographer, if that's what brings you life and brings you joy and family and community. It just wouldn't have been that way for me. I couldn't see a way to answer that question of acquiring money that made me feel alive. What I find in Grandpa Vanderhoff's philosophy is that reminder that I don't have to worry about what I achieve or accomplish. That I can trust that everything I need will be provided for. That I can live as a lily, toiling a little bit, but getting to participate in the making of art and the building of community. A community that, guess what? Includes you. So thank you. Thanks for coming.